Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're with RCR Greenwashed with Jaspreet and Don, and following on from recent discussions we've had about rural and regional New Zealand, today we have MP Stuart Smith. He's the National Party member for Kaikoura, four-term MP. He's got current roles as chairman of the Finance and Expenditure Committee, and he's also on the Inter-Parliamentary Union. Now, Stuart, at the outset, welcome to RCR, but could you explain what the Parliamentary Union is, please?
Thank you, and thank you for having me on. Inter-Parliamentary Union is 180 parliaments around the world belong to it. And while we might think China's a member, for example, we might not associate them with a parliament as such. We all get together at least twice a year. And so this is our second assembly coming up in October next month. And at last one we had in March, we had Israel and a Palestinian delegation. We had the Russians and the Ukrainians there, and we had DRC there as well. And so there wasn't quite open warfare in the meeting, but it's better to have people around the table, as it were, discussing these matters rather than firing shots at one another.
Yeah, and the world is run by, the sovereign nations have an eclectic bunch of leaders around and different philosophies. So it is good that you have some interaction with them. And it's actually one thing I omitted from talking about your bio quickly was you were involved in the New Zealand wine industry. Is what, chairman of the Wine Institute, was it?
It was initially, I was head of the Grape Growers Association. Right. And I was part of the group that pulled the grape growers and winemakers together under one group called New Zealand Wine Growers. Yep. And I was on the board of that for 12 years, and I led the industry for 6 years, from 2006 to 2012.
Well, yeah, that's when I first met you, and you've right. Come a long way. And sort of, isn't it interesting how your pathway takes you to meet with this, as I said, the eclectic bunch of world leaders from different countries? I mean, good on you. You've life, you learn from others, and mixing with others is fantastic. But we have you on this show today to talk about especially the banking inquiry. What do you, it took a while to get this out of the blocks. I know there's a lot of lobbying pre the election last year by the rural sector specifically about this, but it took about 7 or 8 months before it sort of gained enough traction. I think it's now closed, the submissions on it. What's your, did you think it actually had merit? It's perhaps an unfair question. Clearly it had merit, otherwise you wouldn't have done it. But why does an inquiry like this take so long to sort of get out of bed and get action?
Well, quite frankly, our government has had a lot on its plate. And this is an incredibly important thing. We wanted to do it properly, and we needed to get to a point where we could clear the decks to do it. And there's still a lot of work to be done, but we had to advance this in a logical way, and we have. I'm very comfortable with the terms of reference. I think that, Nicola Willis wrote, the Minister of Finance wrote to the Select Committee instructing me to start an inquiry and to include the Primary Production Select Committee, where be talking about rural banking particularly. But overall, actually, we're really looking at banking services, and rural is part of that. But there's business and rural lending products. There's also mortgage lending. All of those things are important. Underlying all that, of course, is the view that our banks are overly profitable in New Zealand when we compare them to other countries. And as a subset of that, that rural banking is getting a particularly hard conditions to operate under, primarily because of, well, it's alleged primarily because of the capital requirements imposed on them by the Reserve Bank. And so I think it's a chunky piece of work, It's a really important piece of work, and it's important we get it right. And so the terms of reference are, I think, wrap that all up quite nicely. So I'm really looking forward to reading the submissions.
Right, because the fear that I had initially was, oh, if interest rates trend down and farmers have a good year or businesses have a good year, and it does seem that certain elements of farming may have a better year, all this just sort of becomes irrelevant. But when I read the terms of reference, you certainly have got a wide-ranging ambit there. And so, yeah, hopefully this thing doesn't just become another report that sits on the shelves, and time just makes it irrelevant. Because I think
Yeah.
this has been bubbling away for a long time, actually, when you analyze it.
Yeah, we had Richard McIntyre here. I think, Don, that was October last year, so we're talking a year ago when we were first talking about the bubbling of dissent coming from the feds. And the article on Newsroom that says the big banks membership of the United Nations-backed Net Zero Banking Alliance could restrict lending, warns a government MP chairing. So that's referring to you. And Stuart, we keep being told that all of these agreements and declarations that we sign up are non-binding. They're voluntary, they're completely non-binding. And yet, at the face of it, it looks like these non-binding agreements are binding us up in knots of all sorts. Of course, I might be biased, the rural sector is from where we've earned our bread and butter, but it is worrying.
Oh, it totally is, Jaspreet. I think one of the things we're looking into is climate-related disclosures and their impact on the lending sector. And I think it's quite important. I think rather than talking about the ag sector, if we look at the energy sector, and because I think this demonstrates the climate-related disclosures quite well. So we are all for renewable energy as much as possible, but ultimately it has to be firmed in some way. When the wind's not blowing and when the sun's not shining, we need to have electricity generated by something. And we know with gas, for example, and coal, they can fit that and fill that niche. Unfortunately, while we've got a shortage of gas, we are going to have a shortage of gas generators as well, with the Taranaki combined cycle plant being closed later. And so, but I have been told by people in the sector that would like to invest in a gas peaking plant, that New Zealand banks are unlikely to give them any money. They will not lend them any money because they're meeting their climate related disclosures. And so that's having potentially a perverse effect on our energy sector. And we have just gone through a winter with blackouts. While the lights didn't go out at home, they certainly went out in industry. And that it would be politically unpalatable to have turning off suburbs one by one to meet our energy shortage of energy
Requirements.
supply, but it seems like it's okay to do it for the productive sector. But unfortunately, real families work in those industries, and when they are not working or when the factory or the business closes down, that has a material impact on them. So we have to be sensible about these sorts of things. I think if we really look at this is a long bow, I suppose, but if you look at the when Henry Ford first started manufacturing cars, the first time they were manufactured, cars have been around for quite a while, but no one got them out readily available. They didn't go out straight away and shoot all the horses. They allowed the cars to take over the horses as and when people were able to afford a car and start driving them. Now, we have to go with renewable energy in the same way, in my view. We will find cheaper and more efficient forms of energy production over time. But right now, if we are where we are at with the sources that we have, and we must ensure we have enough energy. And that means allowing those things to go out of production when they are not needed, not before.
Now, I'm happy you put in that example. You know, we didn't go out and shoot all the horses and that began. I like free markets. I like things to happen in their own time when others see, you know, the merits of what's coming along and they decide themselves voluntarily to make a switch. The Net Zero Banking Alliance was formed at COP26, Glasgow 2021. It's just been a couple of years. And when these banks haven't signed up to the net zero, having a net zero portfolio by 2050, they are now, in a way, pushing those responsibilities that they have signed up to downwards. On the other hand, we have an entity like Air New Zealand, which signed up to stuff and then very conveniently just dumped it because, hey, it's not viable anymore. But farmers don't have that choice, especially with the, you know, last few years being dependent on banks, sky high interest rates, and on-farm inflation is close to 20%. So farmers are dependent on banks. They don't really have that same freedom like Air New Zealand to dump these targets because they didn't choose these targets in the first place.
Well, that's why we're looking at into this very closely because, in New Zealand, we have five major banks, if you count Rabobank and with the Australian Big Four. Yeah. If they've all got the same policy, then effectively we don't have the choice that we should. And that's one of the things, that's why we're looking into that. But as I said, it's tough for the ag sector, but it's also tough for other sectors that materially impact the householder. And the reason why I focus on that is because there are a lot more householders than there are farmers. And ultimately, politically, we have to be able to have the support behind what we're doing. And I think we need to focus that actually these policies, if they are harming New Zealanders, if they're making us less well off, giving us less choices and ability to choose, then we have a problem.
100%.
And so when you hear of, and it's only anecdotal, that there is surcharges going on to rural lending to cover emissions profiling that may not have been done and hasn't been done in actual fact, it does seem that there is something to see here. And it's good that your committee appears to be looking at that and you've got all the submissions in. You know, the other side of it, we're often told if we don't meet these credentials, we don't tick all these boxes as producers, you'll be hindered from market access. You'll get any price premiums will be gone and so on. Do you see evidence of that when you travel around and you clearly do get around the world? Do you see evidence of that? Or is it just the marketing managers of companies saying that because it's convenient?
Well, I think there's a lot of tough talk around the world. Whether that's going to be matched by action is a very open question. Now, Europe in particular is struggling along as it has an energy crisis. As well, far worse than ours, quite frankly. And, you know, industrial countries like Germany losing industrial production because it's going elsewhere where there's more available, cheaper energy. The big move in the United States at the moment is, which is around the world as well, is AI. And that's the new frontier, if you like, of the industrial world, but that requires data centers and lots of them that need lots of energy. And there's a company called Constellation Energy, which have ironically just signed a deal with Microsoft to which will include them opening the closed Three Mile Island nuclear plant to provide energy for their data centers. So you've got Europe going in a completely different direction to the United States, which has a lot of oil and gas and very cheap energy. Sometimes gas is going, sometimes they're being paid to take gas, which is being used to generate electricity for things like data centers. While Europe is trying to put their head in the sand and double down on renewable energy. Renewable energy is great, but you can't just wait for enough of that to work and not fill the gap in the meantime.
In the
United
meantime.
States is not in that same situation, despite the ironically named Inflation Reduction Act, which is actually an oxymoron. But
So listeners, you might be wondering why we started on banking and now we're talking lots more about energy. Stuart Smith was the our guest was the spokesman in opposition for climate change and energy, and clearly has a large amount of knowledge in this as well. So great we've gone on to this, actually, Stuart, because that's one of our, you know, common themes in this show. Just for interest, though, I would like to know this. If there was a clean way of getting coal out of the ground and using it, and perhaps turning, for instance, Eastern Southland lignite, low-grade brown coal, into liquid fuels, would and the emissions from that were down to close to zero, because that'd all be captured and wouldn't be a problem, and there would be a much more efficient process than there was being promoted 10, 15 years ago, would that get out of bed in any parliament in, say, New Zealand or Australia today?
Well, if you care about climate change, you should be fuel agnostic. Focused on emissions. And whether you've got a practical replacement for something that emits more than something else. If you've got a price on it, the market will decide anyway. So in answer to your question, if there was a way to extract coal or lignite and harness the energy from it without having any higher emissions than, or let's say zero emissions, why wouldn't you do that?
And so the reason I put that to Stuart listeners is because in our area there is supposedly thousands of years of brown coal, low-grade brown coal under the ground. Solid Energy formerly, perhaps pre-2010, had it all bought up and were going to start mining and turning their lignite there into liquid fuel, diesel. And the farmers were going to have some byproduct called urea, all in Southland. It would have turned the switch on Southland's economy in a massive way. But we're not allowed to use it according to the current ethos, it seems. But I like your angle, Stuart, being fuel agnostic, if you worry about the climate. I think that's great. I mean, another concern we have, so we have sprayed ourselves around a lot here, is, for instance, offshore wind. We want to be fuel agnostic, though. It does seem a little out of even financial reality to be building offshore wind turbines off Taranaki. I don't see how they can be made profitable unless we're bidding up the price of electricity to that level and making it higher cost for everyone. What's your thoughts on offshore wind?
Well, in a functioning market, if it's not financially available, viable, I should say, it won't happen. So
functioning market is the key, because it seems to be around the world that these turbines, and there seems to have been privilege given, whether it's tax privilege or carbon credits or some other privilege that makes them look viable. But in the end, they come at great cost to the consumer or the taxpayer. And I think the Scottish example right now is one where I think there's £200 million a year in constraints payments being made by the consumers, effectively. So we wouldn't like to see that happen here. Is there any chance that would have to happen here if we were to do offshore wind?
I don't have it in front of me, but I gave a speech to the Renewable Power Conference in Auckland a couple of weeks ago. I gave the minister's speech, and where I very clearly said that we would not be subsidising energy sources. So, I mean, subsidies are maybe appropriate at some point for some industries, but only where there's a market failure that you can't get the industry or whatever it is you need in any other way. And that would normally only be to get something started. But there's no need for that in this case. And I think the biggest well-known player involved in the potential offshore wind in industry in New Zealand is a consortium between Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners and the New Zealand Super Fund. They are well aware that we are not in favour of subsidising. And often, and certainly in Europe, it's what's called CFDs, contracts for difference, so that they underwrite the price effectively. But we're not interested in doing that.
Well, we
Excellent.
shouldn't have to in a small country like New Zealand with an abundance of energy. So, look, I'm heartened to hear that, because and so should consumers be heartened to
And
hear that.
actually, gentlemen, we had discussed this, Don, in the past. The NZGIF, the New Zealand Green Finance Bank, that is already there. That's already doing that to some extent, helping, accelerate this. To have other banks doing this, if I look at Westpac and most of the other big banks, they are now saying the sustainability-linked loans, the green loans that they call it. There is a bit of a discounting there, and one wonders where that's coming from. We've seen the likes of this happening with our food, our processors, Fonterra and the like, who tell farmers if you, and most farmers are doing that stuff already, but if you, tick off a few more boxes, there's a 10 cents premium there. And just one wonders where it stops. So I am so glad you're saying this, that nothing further. We draw a line somewhere.
Yeah, well, those what you've just talked about is the market, and people got as long as it's a functioning market, they can go somewhere else to choose another company to sell their milk to, for example, if they feel that they're not getting a fair deal. So we do need to get around that. I mean, where we do like where government support is relevant in this sense is around EV chargers and charging stations, and that's where we are giving some support to ensure that they get built around the country. And the rationale for that is often there's very expensive upgrades of lines and or transformers needed to get enough juice, if you like, to the area where you want to put the charging stations. And people won't buy cars to use them until they have an ability to get them charged. So there's a bit of a, it's just an early market, getting the market going up and running a little more quickly than it would otherwise. When cars first came out, of course, when we were talking about petrol, it was much easier to set up a petrol station than it would be to set up a charging station, because you need to get the lines there with the electricity, whereas petrol you can cart it there
Taken.
truck.
But the quid pro quo for me on that would be was the petrol stations were, I have no history on this, but they were probably never given a subsidy or a privileged position to set up.
No, I think that's right, but I think it's slightly, as I'm saying, slightly different in that, well, I don't know the history, but I think you're right. Charging stations are a bit harder to get off the ground than a petrol station would be. Back in those days, anyway, they wouldn't worry too much about the environmental standards.
That was the other thing. The other side of it, to concur with what you're sort of saying, and I don't agree though that we should be giving privilege to the sector at all, the EV charging sector, but that's not for me to make the decision, is that there is a huge amount of infrastructure required to set up 50 kV infrastructure charging stations. They are very big cables. Get very hot if you don't have the right capacity going into
That's
those
right.
systems. So look, and I understand it's a big cost for anyone setting them up. But and I am going to challenge you one more step on that. There is plenty of people trying to be providers in the ch EV charging space. There is good competition in there, and if the market was right for them, they would find a way to charge, because they do seem to charge more. The people that charge at these stations, it's not cheap. It's not as cheap as getting off-peak power.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, in Kaikoura itself, there's a Tesla charging station. There's one in Cromwell, not Cromwell. There might be one in Cromwell as well.
I think there
There's
is.
one in Amarama, a EV charging station, which Tesla put in at their expense. they have a large corner of the market, if you like. And so they realized that they couldn't sell their cars unless they had charging stations. So they've done both.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And so we're having a good chat about this. I think this is a bit of a good tit for tat, Stuart, because I would say that you've got the market. You've just explained why the market was working, and Tesla realized that they needed to put stuff in. And I would argue that's great. I don't want to see New Zealand taxpayer funding too many more EV stations. But I know that's on your leader's lips. He often talks about how we're going to fund another 11,000 charging stations around New Zealand. Anyway, look, let's see how that rolls out. I think the EV push, the electrification of New Zealand, I don't have an issue with. I love electricity. Just turn a switch, job's done. If you can turn on a vehicle and that's how it works, great. But we're a long way from that in New Zealand. We're still going to need liquid fuels. And we do seem to be creating a bit of a, from my point of view, a bit of tension around our energy resilience. And I think you've alluded to this energy resilience being quite important, in fact, fundamental for this economy. So shorting any part of it would be a risk. If we can't get our liquid fuels into the country on time and in volume, we've got a problem because we're an export nation that grows things. Are we at risk of having a shortage of liquid fuels anytime soon?
I'm not sure we're at risk, but it is a shame that the Marsden Point refinery was closed. It's a shame that we couldn't refine the oil that we produce at Marsden Point, and it has knock-on effects for like less CO2 to, CO2 is public enemy number one in some areas. People quite like their beer and soda and other things with CO2, where that, you know, it's used heavily in the food industry for preserving and keeping goods fresh, and also for in the medical world as well. So there's a lot of things that CO2 is used for, but we have lost that, and bitumen,
yes,
was coming from, you know, some of it at least was coming from Marsden Point. So yes, that was the smartest thing the previous government did, I don't think. And while they'll say they didn't close it down, they made it pretty awkward for Channel Infrastructure to continue on.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, the demonization of CO2 has gone on too long, not the least these kids who were out on climate marches last weekend. They probably don't realize how much of what they are wearing, they use in their everyday lives is a byproduct of the extraction of fossil fuels. But, you know, again, it's free markets, what Don said and what you are saying. I'm glad we are having the discussion, but for the average taxpayer who's now struggling to put food on the table, mortgages are high. It's going to come down to a point that, do we want more EV chargers? Do we want the public hospitals fully funded? Do we want, because, you know, there's just so much money to go around, and that's what it comes down to ultimately for me. And if we give at some place, we'll have to take it someplace else. And I don't envy your job, Minister, trying to balance it all together. I do not.
Yeah, well, it's ultimately, it's a hard thing. You can't please everyone, and no. I accept that. But I'm pretty much a free market guy, EV charges aside, and that I think, yeah, we're not utilising market mechanisms as well as much as we could and we should. But you know, I better not get off party policy and put all my views out there.
No. Oh, look, we don't mind if you do, but we're not here to put you under the bus. It's interesting. I accept you have not many, you know, there's such a massive change to get back on track that you guys in the coalition are having to do. But I would have suggest, though, that there was a period from perhaps 2005 onwards where National was in Parliament, Labour, then National, then back to Labour, that some of this stuff crept in, and it just seemed that there was always this pressure to do stuff around emissions. And you know, as much as we were pushing the can down the road, the bureaucracy never stopped. And now with the ESG, environmental social governance rulings, the reporting mechanisms around the environmental side of that coming through now at great cost, when I see companies in New Zealand saying, oh, they've finally realised their financial reporting is costing them. And in fact, there was a company last week mentioned $1 million to report on their emissions, profiling, environmental reporting effectively, that might be when it comes home to roost. But the shareholders haven't felt that yet. When they do, what do you think the reaction will be?
Always, when your company's stock is traded daily, if the market decides that you're not doing the right thing by them, that is the shareholders, they will vote with their feet.
Mm. But the trouble is we have this stakeholder capitalism that seems to be driving the ethos through. Some of these companies have allowed the, I call them left of centre thinkers to dictate the terms in their businesses. And to me, it's coming down the line now at great speed and at great cost.
Yes, but I think it will reverse with great speed when and if it impacts on their bottom lines. People ultimately invested money in the share market for returns, either immediate returns by way of
dividends,
dividends, price. Or by long-term investment in those shares so they get a return when they reach their retirement or whatever their goal is. And ultimately, we know from studies everywhere around the world, people are very moralistic about things until it starts to cost them money. And, why do you think Air New Zealand did change their mind? Because they saw that it wasn't possible.
There's no reality check like an economic one.
Yes. And so, the power of the market ultimately does decide. And we're seeing that around the world. We're seeing things change up. And I think while an ESG sounds a very good thing initially, I would say some people would be better off focusing on their balance sheet rather than musing over social issues.
100%.
Yeah, I agree. We talk about the need for just efficiency drivers as number one. It's interesting, Stuart, on the show we've had Owen Jennings on quite a bit and people from the Methane Science Accord. And of course, one of my whole missions in life is to make sure that methane and the ruminant emissions diminished in the scheme of things in terms of taxes and costs against farmers. It seems to mean that it's a good thing that this methane science review is underway, by the way. Hope you're taking notice of that. And secondly, it seems to be, you just mentioned how when people finally observe the true cost of something, they start and set up. I would argue that New Zealand animal agriculture has been the whipping boy for almost 20 years now to avoid mums and dads seeing what the true cost of their CO2 emissions profile might be in their lives. What would you say to that?
I think you're right. But I would also say that methane is an inhibitor on animal performance. And it seems from the little I know about it, if you can reduce your animals' methane emissions, you actually can increase production and animal health. And certainly there's been some work done here that I'm privy to on some feed that reduces methane emissions, but it also increases productivity quite significantly.
And so you would argue then that that's the market mechanisms. The farmers will deploy this new genetics, or they'll deploy their new additives or injections or boluses, because there'll be a market mechanism that will give them profitability and productivity.
Like the driver for the work was to reduce emissions, but the benefactor is going to be productivity. That's a happy coincidence and a good thing to have. And I think so we should be working towards that. But Really, AR6, which is the IPCC's report, was very clear about methane emissions. So we are overstating them by a factor between 3 and 4. And so when you do that, that takes animal emissions or biogenic methane emissions down to about 20% of New Zealand's emissions. So yes, it does make a material impact on the household part of their contribution to reduce emissions. But our emissions, we should be happy about that. Our emissions profile is much lower than it would have been otherwise. And we're very efficient producers of in the rural sector here in New Zealand. And we should always have a future for that, because like with like, you would think, if you really care about emissions, because emissions know no borders, you would want to increase your production in New Zealand because you're getting less emissions per kilogram of product.
And you know, my often said comment is New Zealand already is in gold standard territory here with regards to subsidy-free production systems compared to many of our trade competitors. And yet we never really acknowledge that today nearly enough, that we have that high status. And we should never fear other countries having subsidy-free production. If we could get to that line, I'd be really happy.
Well, it's probably unlikely in the world at the moment. But I want to come back, if you don't mind, to the banking inquiry, because I think one of the things which we haven't touched on is fintechs and their contribution to the changing of our banking sector, which I think is just, we're on the cusp of it, really. As part of the lead up to this banking inquiry, I've been contacted by a number of people and entities in the finance sector. But there are a number of fintechs that are looking to start up. Some are well down the track towards starting in New Zealand. Now, they're not going to necessarily take the banks on head on, but they are certainly going to nibble away at their market share with innovative products that mostly be based online. So they're not going to be bricks and mortar banks, but you don't need bricks and mortar banks necessarily. And they'll offer products at a much lower rate. You know, one is a long-term, long-dated mortgage provider where they borrow long and lend long, whereas our banks borrow short and lend long. So you could have a 30-year mortgage with a fixed mortgage rate, for example. So a much lower barrier for entry to younger people starting out to buy a house. So those sorts of things are coming along. There's platforms, particularly in regard to the rural sector, where people will be able to find access to capital for working capital on a much more competitive rate, where they don't have to go around the banks putting their budgets on to the loan advisors. It'll all be done on a platform. So those things are going to become more available. And I'm sure with that will come other providers of finance outside of those five big banks that we talked about.
We could do with some competition.
Competition,
certainly.
Yep.
Yes, and although I did have a presentation from a group that will remain nameless, but about competition, where they it was put to me that there are only two cola players in the market, and Pepsi and Coca-Cola and Pepsi Cola. And actually, while there's only two, they have a ferocious market battle. So it's not just about the number of people or entities competing. It's about the innovation and competitive nature of that market to try and gain market share. And so that's, I think, what we are lacking. It's not necessarily the numbers of banks, although Kiwi Bank, we are looking into the role of Kiwi Bank as a competitor as part of the banking inquiry. It'll be about the people that they have who will be in charge at Kiwi Bank, that and the ethos that they have about innovation and competition, trying to get their share.
Right. Well, we'll look forward to that. It's another discussion, I think, where we need to probably have. Maybe we'll wait until after the inquiry is completed and your deliberations are in report form. In the meantime, Stuart, great to have you on our show. Please stay on side with the Reserve Bank Governor as much as you can for the next foreseeable future. I say that tongue-in-cheek reading the headline. anyway, good on you. You're doing a good job. And look, we are grateful you could spend some time with us today. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you very much. And I'll take that comment advisedly. But while I didn't come here to make enemies, I didn't come here to ask soft questions. If I'm required to get to the bottom of something, I'm here to do my job and I will ask the tough questions.
Good on you. That's what we need. Fantastic.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.